I'm not going to lie, friends. Great conversation today with Candlebox frontman Kevin Martin on the Radio Chatter podcast. We talk about numerous things, including the 25th anniversary of their debut self-titled album, which comes up on July 20th. We talk about the record, recording the album. We talk about his relationship with some of the guys from the other Seattle bands.
It's great. You know, Lane and I were the best of friends. I had met him when I was 16. I met Chris Cornell when I was 16. Of course, Jerry and all those guys. We shared a rehearsal space next to them at the Music Bank.
We discussed whether he thought they were part of the grunge movement of the 90s, albums that shaped him. What band influenced the name Candlebox? We even get into some talk about Detroit musicians.
I love the White Stripes. Eminem, I think, is hands down one of the greatest rappers in the history of hip-hop rap.
He tells me how much he loves the acoustic storytelling shows. We talk about the original members of the band, keys to success, and a lot more today with Kevin Martin from Candlebox.
From Detroit Rock City.
Detroit Rock City.
This is the Radio Chatter Podcast. Here's your host, Meltdown.
As always, a big thank you for checking out the Radio Chatter Podcast. And like I said in the intro, this is another good one, man. I'll tell you what, Kevin Martin, great to talk to. It's a real thoughtful interview. We touch on a lot of subjects as well. As they're getting ready to celebrate the 25th anniversary of their debut record, Candlebox. This record came out, you know, back, obviously, 25 years ago. But it was on Madonna's Maverick record label. And I think we talked about this last time I talked to Kevin last year. And it spawned four just monstrous hits, went four times platinum. And these guys blew up practically overnight. And, you know, this was in the time of the grunge movement. We talk about the grunge bands that they had played with out there in Seattle. Of course, the friends they had made. And it's just one of those records that, you know, really kind of, it was a top record of the 1990s. There's no question about it. Plus, he even mentions, and I've never heard this before, he mentions an album of his that he hates. Now, that's so funny because I've never asked any artist, you know, name a record you just don't like of your own. But he just offered this one up. And I don't think it's the first time he's talked about this, but it's a pretty funny revelation when you get right down to it. So, in the meantime, Kevin, a true pro, called right on time. And we got the interview rolling with Kevin Martin today from Candlebox on Radio Chatter.
What's up, bro?
How you doing, man?
I'm good, brother. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I see you're coming to town. So I say, hey, talk to Kevin. I'm like, all right, fine. That's what we're doing. So...
That's tough.
It's a tough life, man. So I'm rolling. We'll get this done and get you on your way here. Like I said, July 13th at Woodhaven. And now you guys are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the debut record. Are you doing the record in its entirety, or how's this work on this tour coming up?
Well, rumor has it, but the thing is like the 25th anniversary isn't actually until July 20th. So that's the day the record is released.
Right.
So I'm not sure if we're going to play it. I honestly even don't know how much time we have it at the jam. It's usually they give us like an hour and 15, which, you know, would work. But, you know, it all kind of depends on how we're feeling. You know, we write the set list every single night, before we go on, and we change it up. So, you know, you may get the whole record, you may only get 9 of the 11 songs, but, you know, especially like a song like Rain, which is, you know, 7.5 minutes long or 8 minutes long or whatever. I don't know, but, you know, the guys in the band are kind of pressing me to do it, so we may do it. It really is just kind of up in the air at the moment.
Yeah, now it says here you do an hour and 15 minutes. Actually, it says 10:15 to 11:30. It says here on this, you know, the internet, so, you know, whatever. So, yeah, so the guys in the band, well, that's funny. So there's no original members in the band except for yourself, correct?
Yeah, well, Dave Cruzan, he's not original, but he's actually joined us in 96.
Okay.
After Scott left, so... He's kind of an original. He's actually played on more albums than Scott. He's played on 5 of the 6 records. So, I'd say he's kind of an original member.
Yeah, right. So, he fought the battles. He did the time with you for sure. But are the other guys? They got to be like kind of like I don't know, maybe like fans looking from the outside in. Like, dude, do the record, man. Let's do it.
I think that's exactly what's happening. Especially Brian. Excuse me. He's our lead player. He's. You know, he grew up on Candlebox, and you know, so like this is a dream come true for him. He's like, dude, if we get to play that whole record, I'm going to be like a pig in poo, you know. But I think he's the one that's pressing me the most about it.
Yeah. What do you remember most about making that album? I'm sure you've heard this question before. Sorry for the hack question, but give me some thoughts on the record.
No, nobody's ever asked me that. So you're the first.
Really? Okay.
The memories of that album, you know, are all crazy fond. You know, we have there's actually an outtake stat tape that our engineer made for us, which is basically all of our tantrums and funny moments, which, you know, I listen to at least once a year just to remind myself of how much of an idiot I am. But we, you know, we had such a great time making that record, and you know, we did it at London Bridge, which is a historic studio in Seattle, with this amazing engineer John Plum and great producer Kelly Gray, and you know, we had we actually had one thing. It was an April Fool's joke we played on Scott, our drummer. We had told him that the tape machine had spit out one of the reels, and we'd lost 10 songs. And that he needed to come back to the studio and track those 10 songs. And he didn't even realize, first of all, that you can only get 3 songs on a reel of tape, and that it was April Fool's Day. And he had just shoved his hand into the wall at his house and sprained his index finger, his middle finger on his left hand, which is his control finger. And he was like, I can't. I'm on my way to the hospital right now. I've sprained my finger. We're like, dude, we're going to have to call somebody else. And he's like, I'll be right there. So he came all the way out to the studio, and we filmed the whole thing. We have the whole thing on film, and he's freaking out. And, you know, we just take this old reel of tape and thrown it all over the place, and just had a great laugh with him. But so there's stuff, a lot of stuff like that, you know, like playing jokes on one another and drinking way too much whiskey and having far too much fun. And I think you can hear it in that record for sure.
Now, was this record, when you went in, of course, you know, it's your debut and stuff, but this is the one that you really want to, you know, you can prepare a long time to make, you know, and of course, as they say, you know, the world's only going to wait so long for your next record. But did you guys have all these songs written? And I mean, were you guys pounding out these songs for years and years playing clubs and different things?
Not years. I mean, a lot of them on the record had been, you know, played for almost a year and a half, maybe 2 years, but Blossom and He Calls Home and No Sense were written in December of 92 before we went to the studio. So those were the only 3 songs we really didn't have time to work on. Although Far Behind and You are the actual original demos from our 1991 recording session. So those are demos that we actually remastered to fit the sound of the album.
Really? Wow, that's cool. Man, that's funny. By the way, you just mentioned something I had to jot down in my notes here. Dat tape. I haven't heard that mentioned in a long time.
Yeah, I don't think it exists anymore, to be honest with you. But
I think we have a dat machine in the studio here at the station, but I used to use those all the time. Yeah, right. So, yeah, send me some dats. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I used to use those all the time. But so now tell me about the you know, obviously this record, you know, blew up, and tell me about, you know, what your thoughts were at the time when this record is just like exploding.
It was overwhelming. I mean, you know, we started out on tour in a van. We took a band out with us called Greta that, you know, we were great friends with, and we did 6 months with them, and then Living Color had invited us to come out in the fall of 93, and we did 6 weeks with Living Color, which was, you know, a total eye-opener as to really great musicianship and character and you know, just really beautiful human beings. Those 4 guys in that band, Living Color, are just incredible guys. They taught us a lot about the road. They taught us a lot about respect and audiences and shows and set lists. And so, of course, that was, you know, another great moment in our lives. And at that point, I think our record was at like 250,000 units. Then, of course, in January of 94, we picked up with Rush, and we toured with them for 16 weeks for a little over 3 months. Got a gold record in the middle of that tour, and by the end of that tour, in April or May rather, we had gone platinum. So, you know, it was it was fast, and I think, you know, like, we, you know, we're the only band to play Woodstock 94 who had a record in the Billboard top 10. Actually, top 20. We had the number 7 record. Nobody else at Woodstock had a record in the top 20 at all. So, you know, our heads were spinning, and I think we tried our best to, you know, handle it and deal with it as I guess humanly as possible. But, you know, it's at the same time, you're thrown into this crazy world. And then, of course, we did the tour with Metallica that summer, and then, you know, the rest is history for us. So very, very shocking and exciting and overwhelming and nutty. Yeah,
man, I can't even imagine. It's funny you mentioned that Woodstock 94. I was there. I forgot you guys played that show. That's right. I remember seeing Henry Rollins, Nine Inch Nails, all sorts of bands. Yep. God, that was so good. Man.
That was a great one. We did the Friday night with, and the funny thing was, it was with the headliners were Live, Collective Soul, Candlebox, and Violent Femmes for
wow.
Friday night. So
yeah,
it was pretty exciting time, I think, for everybody.
I remember getting on a bus, like the media had like this bus where it'd take you to, I don't know, some sort of satellite parking lot or something like that. Anyway, so I'm underneath this one street light, and I look over, and Bill Maher is standing next to me. And he, at the time, he was just like pretty much just a comedian. And I said one of the stupidest things I've ever said to a human being in my life. I go, "Hey, you're effing Bill Maher."
And he's like, "Yeah, hey, I effing am."
Yeah, that's right. It's like, what a dumb comment to make. But so you're touring with all these big bands now. I'm trying to think as you were just talking that did you guys tour with Van Halen at one point too?
No, we were supposed to do Europe with them.
Okay, maybe I'm getting mixed
Chains,
up here.
Alice in Chains did Alice in Chains toured with them in 92. We never did. We were supposed to do Europe with Van Halen and Bon Jovi, and it didn't work out, which was a big bummer for us because that was a massive tour that would have, you know, really solidified us around the world. But, you know, shit happens, and pardon my French.
Oh, you're good.
You know, and you move on, and you live and you learn. We did tour with Aerosmith in 98, which was, you know, again, another mind-blowing experience because that was my favorite band growing up. And, you know, just it's been a crazy 25 years, man. I can't lie to you.
Yeah, I can imagine. You just mentioned Alice in Chains and stuff. What was your relationship like with the bands from Seattle?
It was great. You know, Lane and I were the best of friends. I had met him when I was 16. I met Chris Cornell when I was 16. Of course, Jerry and all those guys. We shared a rehearsal space next to them at the Music Bank in Seattle back in the 90s. I never knew Eddie, but I knew Jeff and Stone very, very well from Other Love Bone. Andy Wood, of course, was one of my best friends. I wrote Far Behind about him when he passed. Mm. You know, it was a really cool, tight-knit community of musicians, very much like, you know, the Detroit scene or the Michigan scene, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, where they all kind of played together or were friends or at some, you know, one point or another had been in a band together. It was very supportive and really cool, you know, to kind of grow up in that scene.
Now, I'm trying to remember the last time I talked to you. I know it was last year, and I'm trying to remember if we talked about the passing of Chris Cornell, but I was at that last Soundgarden show, and I've talked about this before, but I can remember the first time I played Outshined on the radio when it was brand new, and I'm like, whoa, this is pretty cool. And then to see the last show, it's kind of like, you know, kind of mind-boggling, you know?
Yeah, that was a really awful experience, I think, for a lot of people, you know, not only the people that were at the show to know that was the last time they were going to see him, but just, you know, musicians in general and fans in general to lose somebody of that caliber of a musician at you know, far too early of a stage in their career. You know, I think Soundgarden was moving very rapidly towards another amazing, you know, album, another super unknown. And it was a shock. We did speak about that briefly. I think about him almost every day because, you know, the music comes on the radio and I think, you know, God, I knew that guy when I was 16 years old, and how lucky am I to have known him as long as I did. I wish I could pick up the phone and talk to him right now. You know, it'd be great, but you know, life changes and it changes rapidly. And that must have been a real experience to see that show. I wish that I had been there to see that because it would have definitely been something special.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like you don't think you're watching the last Soundgarden show, you know. it just doesn't even dawn on you at all. So, hey, when did you move to Seattle as a kid?
14 years old in 1984.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I didn't think that you were actually originally from Seattle, but the band was and stuff. And, you know, I asked Robert DeLeo about this a couple months ago because those guys were from San Diego and stuff. Now, do you think that Candlebox was really really fit in the grunge scene, or were you guys, do you guys just consider yourself a rock band, or what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think we were, you know, more so, the arena rock blues-based band. Mm. You know, we didn't have that slow, dirgy, you know, kind of metal influence in what we were doing. You know, there's a lot more pop, if you will, in our sound. If I would compare us to anybody at the time, it would have been, you know, Pearl Jam with the Alive album, which is, you know, full of hooks and melodies and blues riffs and stuff like that. And that's kind of what you know, what our sound was. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you think about Mudhoney, Mother Love Bone, you know, Alice, Soundgarden, the Melvins, Nirvana, you know, it's all kind of dark and heavy and slow. And, you know, we had a lot of light in our songs. So I don't think we really fit into that very well. And, you know, being a band from Seattle, it was hard because we were about 4 and 5 years in age younger than all those guys. You know, I'm only 49 years old. So, you know, I think Jerry's 54. Chris would have been 54. Eddie's, I think, going to be turning 55. You know, there's a big difference between 14 and 19. In age, so I didn't really have those kind of influences. And of course, not being from Seattle, moving there from Texas, I was just a punk rock kid. So, you know, I learned the ropes up there rather quickly when I moved there.
Now, somebody challenged me on the internet to post like the 10 albums that shaped me or whatever, you know, and I think the first one I put on there was Blizzard of Oz because we're the same age. And when I heard Crazy Train for the first time, I'm like, there was no turning back. That was the switch that turned it on for me. What band or album or whatever got you?
Oh, I would say probably London Calling by The Clash.
Yeah.
You know, that was my first kind of experience of rock and roll. And then, you know, it was Aerosmith. My older brother, you know, had the Toys in the Attic record, and I was obsessed with it. I never really listened to metal. It's funny. I joke about it all the time because I about 4 years ago downloaded all the Iron Maiden records, and of course Killers is my favorite, and I'm like, why did I miss out on this for so long? You know, I could have been listening to this when I was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was kind of full circle for me to kind of visit the metal thing. But I would say, you know, The Clash, that first record, and of course Kiss Alive and stuff like that. But The Clash was the one that really kind of grabbed me, and I was like, what is this? You know, it's full of hooks, it's full of melody, and it's punk, you know, and there's a statement to those songs, you know, and I think even with Candlebox, you know, songs like Stand and You and I Got a Gun and whatnot, you know, I've always tried to make some sort of statement in my music about my experiences in life in general and things that affect me, and that really comes from The Clash.
It's really fun, though, to discover music that's been around for so long that you might have missed, isn't it?
Oh, I was a kid in a candy store. I mean, you know, I'd get on the bus and I was like, dude, this song, and Adam would just start laughing. He's like, yeah, I know the song. I'm like, this is crazy.
No, but I'm talking about even as an adult, you're talking about you just downloaded all the Maiden records. You're like, man, you know, all this stuff you missed. You know, I got back into vinyl last year and I've gone on this crazy, ridiculous vinyl hunt now. And I don't know, maybe 5 months ago, I bought this Angel record. My wife's like, oh, I love this band because of Punky Meadows or something. And growing up in Buffalo, now I've been in Detroit for, you know, over 22 years, but I never heard of Angel. I didn't even want to listen to it. I put it on the other day. I'm like, this is great. I got to buy all of them now.
Oh, yeah. They were a great band. I think actually Gene Simmons found them, didn't he?
Yeah. Casablanca Records, you know, the whole thing. Like when you were a kid and, you know, you saw that famous record label, you know?
Yeah, that's when you bought a record because of the record label.
So it's cool to discover that kind of stuff. You touched a little bit on Detroit, you know, in the music scene here and stuff like that. Did any of that stuff influence you in your life?
Oh, 100%. MC5, you know, Iggy and the Stooges, the Motown sound is, you know, I've always loved R&B. My mom was a huge Otis Redding fan, you know, and that's also something that really kind of formed my opinion of music, was that Detroit scene. You know, I love the White Stripes. Eminem, I think, is hands down one of the greatest rappers in the history of hip hop rap.
Yeah.
And I think it's a state that just continues to produce phenomenal phenomenal musicians and music. There's something in the water there, you know. and the great thing is it's also diverse, you know. It really is. Yeah, from Bob Seger to the Stooges, you know. I mean, it's crazy to me that state has constantly produced just unbelievable music. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that you guys toured with that band Greta back in the day. Now there's Greta Van Fleet.
Yeah. I don't even talk about those guys.
You don't want to talk about Greta Van Fleet? You're not a fan?
Yeah, I listen. You can you can play. It's like the scene in Spinal Tap when Nigel Tufnel says, you know, Jimmy Page wrote this when he was 25. I could play it when I was 16. I think that says a lot. you know, I listen. Great players, and I'm happy for their success. You know, because they're young kids and people love them, and you know, I've heard Led Zeppelin and I've heard Kingdom Come, and I don't need to hear it again. But you know, that's just my opinion. That's all it is. I don't have to like everything. You don't have to like everything. And I don't, you know, I don't judge people on their musical tastes, and I don't judge musicians on what they choose to do or how they choose to play music. I have my opinions, and that's all it is.
That's hysterical. You bring up Kingdom Come. I just saw yesterday they're thinking about doing a 30th anniversary tour around their first record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, Kingdom Come.
Because of the success of Greta Van Fleet.
So it's their fault.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, you did
but
this.
You didn't hear that from me.
Right. There you go. You know what? I got to be honest. I can't let this go right away. But I saw those guys. They played 3 sold-out shows here at the Fillmore in downtown Detroit last month. Wow. And, you know, they're really good musicians. I mean, obviously, Josh here sounds like Robert Plant, you know, and they got this classic rock feel. But, you know, they're playing their own songs. They're doing their own thing. So, you know, but I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And listen, you know, like I said, it doesn't mean they're not good, and it doesn't mean that people shouldn't hear them. You know, what my opinion is of it. It's, you know, it's just, I've heard it.
Yeah, they're one of those bands where when you bring them up, people have a reaction, whether it's good or bad, you know? So
gotta roll.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, you've done these acoustic tours and, like, you know, the storytelling and different things like that. Do you like doing that stuff?
I love it.
Yeah, and now you don't have a chance to hide behind the amps or nothing. That gets you a little bit closer to the people.
Yeah, you know, and it's the attachment to the instrument as well. Not only the guitar, but you know, the vocal cords. You know, what the gift that I've been given as a singer and the ability that I have to use it the way I want to use it in such an intimate setting is. You know, I'd have told you years ago I would never do it because I didn't have that much faith in my abilities as a musician. You know, I've always kind of been the reluctant lead singer of Candlebox. I started out as a drummer. I was in a punk band when I moved to Seattle playing drums, and I did that up until I was 19 years old. So when I got stuck with this gig 27 years ago, you know, it's I've been trying to shake it ever since. So. For me to sit down with an acoustic and play in front of people that way, you know, I don't do it at parties. I don't do it at my home when my wife and son are home. I still get kind of nervous about it. But the fact that, you know, I can go out and play those songs in front of people that appreciate what I've done, it makes it easier for me. So I've learned to just fall in love with it over the past. I shouldn't say learned. I've really fallen in love with it over the past 2 years. And the response is, you know, when you can play a song and you can hear a pin drop in the room of 500-700 people, that's pretty special.
Yeah. You know, you're not the first person I've ever talked to. I mean, just off the top of my head, Brad Arnold from Three Doors Down and James Hetfield from Metallica. And even Sully from Godsmack are guys that were just thrust into the singing part. And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you get thrown into it, and then of course when it sticks, you're stuck. So,
what kind of stories do fans ask you to talk about in these things?
You know, mostly it's just about the meanings behind the songs, or like if I have an interesting story about how the song was, you know, developed or produced, or techniques that we used on certain, you know, parts of the songs on the records and stuff like that. You know, they want to hear the stories behind them and what inspired them and what they're about and really the history of it. You know, I got 25 years of songs that I'm playing, and I just, you know, I pinch myself every day that I have that.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got six albums worth of music to pull from, and I don't get, you know, rarely do I get somebody saying, you know, I really wish you'd have played, you know, this song. Because it is so intimate. You know, it's supposed to be about an hour and a half long, and it ends up sometimes being about 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
because I go so far in depth into, you know, the history of the song. So, but, you know, people are drinking and having a laugh that whole time, so I guess it works. But, yeah, it's really just, you know, letting them into kind of my world for that hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I got to see one of these things. I don't think you haven't done it in the Detroit area, right?
I did actually at the Machine Shop, but that was years ago. I have not done Detroit proper. I would like to. I would like to do it. You know, geez, if I could fill the Fillmore with it, it'd be amazing, but I don't think that would be, you know, even remotely possible. But, you know, maybe some small venue that you know, 500 or 600 people could enjoy the evening. I would love to, because it's a lot of fun for me.
Yeah. Hey, a couple more things here for you, Kevin, then we'll let you fly. First of all, have you talked to Peter Klatt lately? Are you guys, you know, friends? You guys communicate together, or how's that work?
Yeah, I just talked to him about 5-6 days ago.
Yeah.
We have these two shows coming up in Seattle with the original band.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're gearing up for that. So yeah, but he and I talk all the time. You know, everybody's got lives outside of you know, Candlebox, so that's kind of the reason that we don't tour together anymore. He's got this, you know, production team and producing gig that he does in Florida that keeps him incredibly busy, and it would be stupid for him to walk away from that. And Barty's an attorney in Seattle, and Scott's got a water filtration control system that you know, does very well for him, and it's basically a lot to do with what happened with the water system in Flint, Michigan. So Washington State passed a law that people have to have these regulators, and so that's Scott's business, and it's been his business for the past 10 years. So, you know, they've got lives outside of this band, and this is really the only life I have.
Yeah. Now, are the guys in the band now excited to watch the shows when the original members come up?
Yeah, I've got them all booked out there, and I brought them all out, and I'm like, you know, you got to be there. You know, you're my band now. You've been my band now for 3 years, and you know, it's on me. So come on out. So yeah, they're excited.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. What are your thoughts about the passing of Vinnie Paul? Did you know VP at all?
I did not know Vinny. I knew of him. Amazing musician, amazing drummer. I was shocked. You know, that's just too young. It's just too young. And I hope it was natural.
Right.
I don't even know if they've figured out what it is. But you know, he was a partier. You know, I mean, for God's sakes, and you can only run your body so hard for so long. But yeah, that was a sad one. Of course, I'd met him a couple times, but I did not know him.
Now, you just alluded to the fact that you've been able to do this for 25 years. You got all these albums under your belts and stuff. What are the keys to your success personally and with the band?
Whiskey and cigarettes, I suppose.
Hey, if that were the keys to success, I'd be more successful.
No, I don't know, man. I think it's just we've always... You know, I think, look, the first album it really solidified our career. And, you know, the fact that the riff plays far behind every single day. And you know, we have that fan base that has allowed us to continue to make records. I think that's really, you know, and we make great records. You know, we don't put out crap.
Mm-hmm.
We never have. We've always had, listen, there's one or two songs on every record that people don't like. And then there's a whole album like Lucy that I don't like, but,
you don't like the Lucy, you know, album?
I hate it. But you know, it's, and again, it's not a crap record. There's great songs on that record, but, you know, we've always put out really good albums, and we've given our audience what it is that they expect of us. And I think that that's why we're still here.
I've never had an artist tell me they hate one of their records.
Oh, God. Well, you should ask him more.
I should.
When you talk to him, which record of yours do you hate?
Is that right? Do you think that there's every artist just has a record that's like, I just don't like that album, huh?
Absolutely.
Wow. I never thought about that before.
We are our own worst critics, man.
Wow. That's something, man. Hey, final thing here for you. Talking about albums and stuff. Are you guys working on anything new? You got anything in the any irons in the fire or anything?
We are. We're not doing albums anymore. We're doing like 3-song, 5-song EPs. Okay. I've got one that I'm recording in August. It'll come out probably in October. I'm not worried about, you know, setting up records anymore. It's just about giving the fans new music so that they've got something to enjoy and to keeping myself busy outside of touring.
Now, how am I supposed to put a 3-song download on my turntable? That's the question I have.
Well, then what you do is you wait for me to release all of those EPs on vinyl next year.
Is that what you're going to do? That sounds great, man.
Yeah, that's the concept. I mean, you know, I love vinyl myself. I'm a big advocate of it. I've got well over 1,000 pieces in my collection, and you know, it's always been my kind of frustration with producing records that we don't do more vinyl because our fans love it, you know. But yeah, so I'll take all 3 of those EPs and throw them on vinyl next year, and that'll come out in summer.
Now, what artist is the most you own on vinyl?
Oh God, that would be between Roxy Music and The Clash.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I was a huge Roxy Music fan. I mean, all the, you know, from you know, the Brian Eno, Brian Ferry days, all the way up to, you know, Brian Ferry's solo stuff with Bette Noir and Boys and Girls and stuff like that. I there's something I think magical about the way Brian writes music. I was always, every time a record came out, I bought it. So I've got well over maybe 15 Roxy Music records, and The Clash, I'd say probably with all the B-sides and the 45s, maybe 20 pieces.
Huh. I don't have any of either. I might have to, that might be something on the list I might have to start to dive into. Cause I'm looking, I was always looking for new stuff that I didn't really grow up on, but I was listening to Midnight Oil today. You know,
that's how we named the band. We named the band Candlebox after Midnight Oil song.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Song called Tin Legs and Tin Minds. It's on the Countdown record.
No kidding. So you're a big Midnight Oil fan growing up, or that
huge?
Really?
Huge. Yeah.
Yeah, I just listened to the whole record, say the Beds Are Burning album. Loved it.
So it's fantastic. And on vinyl, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, it really does. Well, listen, man, we'll let you fly. I really appreciate the time there, Kevin. We'll see you guys, Uncle Sam Jam, coming up on July 13th. Are you okay there?
Maybe.
Hey, man, safe travels.
Thanks,
can't
buddy.
Wait to see the show.
All right, my man. We'll see you soon.
There he is, Kevin Martin from Candlebox, today on Radio Chatter. And like I told you guys at the onset, I mean, this is a pretty good conversation. No time constraints. I can just talk to him. There's no third-person caller. There's no delay. It's like just right there. So had a chance to talk with him last year as well. He's always a great interview. And I'll link that up in the description of the show today. So if you want to go back and check that out from last year, you can. By the way, I've had some really good interviews lately. Alita Ford the other day. Phil Collin from Motorhead. Our tribute to Vinnie Paul that I unfortunately had to do last week as well, as we lost VP, of course. And I guess the memorial over the weekend down there in Texas went off really well. A lot of bands showing up, a lot of fans showing up as well. I guess they set up his drum kit right there, his silence drum kit. That might have hurt me just a little bit. But anyway, so rest in peace, my friend Vinnie Paul. So go back and check out some of those podcasts as well. Hey, follow me on social media at MeltdownWRIF, and keep coming back. Maybe subscribe, because I've got some irons in the fire, as well as interviews coming up that you're going to want to hear. Of course, it's the summer concert season, and a lot of things happening. Hey, as always, thank you so much for checking out Radio Chatter. Until we do it again next time.